no, you actually gave me everything because you told me the things that you were passionate about and that made you happy. And now that you're surrounded by those things, they're really filling your cup because you're surrounding yourself by things that aren't just from a magazine, aren't just because some designer said that this is the way your home should look. You filled your home with things that really spark joy for you. And that's what your home should do.
Hello, hello, and welcome to episode 128 of the Mad Happy Podcast. This is Phineas. Today, I'm excited to introduce an episode with Bobby Burke. Bobby is an Emmy Award-winning television host, author, and interior designer, originally coming to fame with the incredibly popular Netflix series Queer Eye. He is author of a new book, Right at Home, How Good Design is Good for the Mind. This was a fascinating conversation between Mason and Bobby. They cover a lot, and I think you're really going to enjoy it. So without further ado, the Mad Happy Podcast is brought to you by Optimism. Enjoy the show with Mason and Bobby Burke.
How are you, man? Thanks for coming on the show.
Good, good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I know you were traveling a bit. Are you sort of back in town now?
No. As soon as I'm done with this, I have to go to Newport Beach. And then Friday, I go to San Diego. And Saturday, I go to Chicago. And then I think I'm home for at least a good week.
Yeah, and that's all. Is that like book stuff or just other work stuff? Or
a little bit of both. A little bit of book stuff, a little bit of other work stuff. I just got back from North Carolina yesterday. So.
Are you doing like a proper like tour of the book?
Yeah, I did. For 2 weeks I was on the road, and now it's just like little appearances here and there. Feels like it's been going on for about a month now.
Nice. Before we start, I guess just curiously, are you familiar with like the brand at all or what we do?
A bit. Yeah.
Okay, nice. I mean, just to give you further background, I mean, we started like 7 years ago really around this idea and this word of like mad happy, right? Sort of like embracing the ups and downs of life and like the inevitable struggles that we'll all face and sort of like creating a brand that sort of flipped the landscape of like streetwear and like fashion on its head at the time. You know, I grew up in LA. It was very sort of exclusive and dark and negative, and we really wanted to create something that was much more positive and inclusive and really encourage people to be themselves. And really this whole idea of like mental health wasn't really a thing back in 2017. And I think now it's been like amazing to just see how far the conversation has come, and was so excited to speak to you, obviously, because I feel like there's such an inherent tie in like mental health and design that like no one has really spoken about, which like you obviously chose to prominently display with your book. And yeah, man, excited to have you on.
Great, thanks for having me.
I was reading a little bit about your upbringing and definitely wanted to start there. I can relate to your story a little bit. I was adopted also. I moved around. I was born in Colorado, then moved back to Michigan, then was in LA by the time I was four and sort of grew up there. But would love to just learn a little bit more about your background and sort of that, you know, turbulent kind of hectic upbringing that you experienced.
Yeah, you know, I was born in Texas, and my biological mom was like super young when she got pregnant. She was 16. So her older sister and husband decided to adopt me. So my biological aunt and uncle became my mom and dad. And like my biological mom, I think of her as my aunt. I still do. She's still in my life, but as my aunt.
How old were you at that time? Like an infant?
Yeah. Infant. Adopted at birth. And so within 3 days of being born, my parents took me to Missouri, where I grew up. I lived there until I was 17, where then I also went to Colorado. But at 15, I left home, moved out, went out on my own. You know, I lived in a very small conservative town and a small conservative family. And it was one of those, like, I got to get out of here. I got to be able to be who I am. I've got to not wear a mask every day, and not an N95, but, you know, a mask of, oh, I'm this straight kid in Missouri and I like girls and football and, you know, this and that. And it became a bit much to play that role that was not me every day. Things were a little turbulent at home as well. So one day I just decided to leave. And I went to the big city of Springfield, Missouri. And I was there for about two and a half years. And then I moved to Colorado.
Did the dynamic growing up, like being raised by your aunt and uncle, but I assume you call them like your parents, obviously,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they're my parents, yeah.
how did they communicate that to you? Like, did they wait for you to be a certain age, or was it sort of just like understood, or like was
No, they actually told me when I was like 8, I think, 7 or 8. Just one day after church.
You feel so young.
Yeah, I know. I don't know if I've ever really asked my mom what her thought process was of telling me that young, but yeah, just, I remember one day after church, my parents set me down and they're like, I think they were afraid I was going to find out another way. Cause my older sister, every time she would get mad at me, she'd be like, "You're adopted."
Just like the classic.
And I remember being like, "Mom," yeah, I'd be like, "Mom, what's adopted?" And my mom would be like, "Shauna, stop telling him that." You know, so I think it was probably just like, I think they'd rather me hear it from them than my sister keep telling me and me eventually figure out what that meant. And I remember like not really caring, like,
right. Like, okay, that doesn't really change anything right now.
Yeah. But I remember my mom seemed very emotional about it and like, "Oh, this is a really big deal." So I then switched gears and I remember like reacting to being like, "Whoa," you know, and like matching her emotion level and like running out into the field and climbing up into a tree and like hiding there for the afternoon. But I still kind of just like, it wasn't a big deal to me, and it still isn't.
It's interesting. I mean, like, just to hear you say that it's not a big deal, because I kind of like agree in like a weird way. Like for me, like, my biological father left me and my mom like immediately when I was like a couple months old. And then I moved back with her to Michigan, where she grew up. She ends up meeting another guy who adopts me, becomes my dad. He has 2 kids from his previous marriage. So I get those 2, and then they have 2 of their own. So I grew up with 5 siblings, but all this very like blended thing. And it sort of is in the moment. You're like a kid and you don't really know any different of like, this is just my life. This must just be normal. Like, I'm fine. I'm like, I'm good. And then I feel like it really isn't until like, for me, you know, 20 plus years later, where it's like, now these things have like manifested in like different ways or things like that. And it's like, oh, that like, that has to do with all that, you know, like that's really what it meant. Maybe that's why my parents were like treating things like such a big deal, where like, I didn't think they were a big deal. And it's like it's an interesting balance of like, they don't matter, but they can matter if like you don't really talk about them, or just sort of like all of that, you know, everyone has their own sort of like story and upbringing in that way.
Yeah. I mean, luckily I still don't really think of it as a big deal, but maybe I'm just, you know, hiding it all down deep inside. And one day I'm just going to snap. I don't know.
Yeah, no. Well, then I think it's like you brought up like the sexuality piece. It's like, it seems like that almost was sort of your like trauma, or like your thing to sort of break through in a way that like the family was almost stability, and like that was sort of
It's funny you should say that, because my mom said a lot of times I was like an angry child, and she attributed it to me being adopted, and she thought that all that manifested anger was about me being adopted, right, and not feeling loved.
Never had that. Yeah.
It hadn't. I mean, to me, maybe subconsciously, but you know, it had nothing to do with that. It was like, there was not one person in the world who knew who I was and that I could actually be my true self with. And
when
you hide your true self every single day to every single person in the world, it starts to manifest as some, you know, pretty fucked up emotions.
Yeah. I mean, I can relate. So the guy who adopted me and is my dad. He actually came out in 2010, and it like, he experienced a lot of anger, like when we were growing up too, and like was like a very angry dad and was like super confusing as a kid, right? You're thinking like, is this my fault? Is this not, whatever? And like when my parents got a divorce and he came out, it was like the biggest weight ever lifted off my shoulders of just like, holy shit, like it wasn't my fault. You know, I was totally able to empathize with this guy of like you said, like wearing a mask for like 40, 50 years of life, like really, really can't even imagine. So I think anger is obviously a super like super common theme there. Did you say you ran away at 15 or just like decided? Yeah. Like what, I guess, how did you like muster up the courage, or did you have any sort of support from friends, or was it like in the middle of the night, like, F you guys, I'm out? Like what, how did that sort of go down?
I remember like we got in a big fight about something. I don't even remember. And my parents were always like, if you don't like the rules, there's the door. And all so right, that night I was like, okay. You know, and I did have a friend that at the time, like, you know, I went to stay with her and she took me in and gave me a place to stay. But yeah, it was, you know, my parents weren't bad parents. You know, they were parents that were fucked up by religion.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're taught to do and act a certain way because that's what the Bible tells you to do. And if you have a, you know, and I was just a kid who just honestly just wanted to have friends. I just wanted to have a life. And my parents were so, mainly my mom. My mom was so protective of not allowing us to be around anybody that wasn't a Christian, and that she didn't know their parents and their beliefs, that it just, it made for a pretty lonely childhood. Cause
yeah,
you know, most of the time kids and their parents didn't want to deal with the application process that it took for my mom to allow us to hang out with anybody. So, you know, I remember my mom had these books like Raising the Strong-Willed Rebellious Child. And looking back, I was like, I was such a good kid. Right. I really just wanted to go out and fucking play. Right. You know?
I was looking for some action, yeah.
Yeah, you know, but like compared to my sister was super shy and an introvert and like was just happy riding her horse and like being on the farm. And like, just like she didn't need to be around people. And so it made me even look even more, you know, strong will. But I was like, yeah, I just want to go out to pizza after church with the youth group. Like,
is that too much to ask?
Yeah, I don't think at 15 my bedtime should be 8:30. You know, things like that. But you know, so we butted heads a lot.
And then you said you landed in Colorado after you left home.
Yeah. So well, I landed in Springfield, Missouri.
Oh right.
That was like from 15 to 17 ish.
And was that like, you know, like bright eyed, bushy tailed boy in like a big city for the first time, sort of like
in Springfield,
taking it all in? Yeah.
I wouldn't call Springfield a big city. Springfield is just like a big town.
Right, a big town, rather.
No, but I mean, it was great actually being able to meet and find gay people and gay friends and actually just like be out and my true self. And for the first time in my life, just be me.
Yeah.
That was pretty amazing. You know, it was definitely, you know, I lived in my car at some times. I was homeless at some point. You know, it wasn't easy, but it was fine because I was me.
Yeah. Looking back, I guess, like what do you feel like that experience like taught you the most, like in hindsight? I mean, like to be where you are now and then literally have times where you were homeless and I'm sure like struggling day to day just to sort of feel like you could be yourself. I mean, it's a hell of an accomplishment.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it taught me that just being yourself is worth whatever you have to go through. Then, yeah, at 17, I kind of had a mental meltdown one day. You know, I was working the graveyard shift at a gas station and I was a stock boy at the Gap and was working at the body shop and, you know, at Applebee's. I had like four jobs and I was still barely able to pay my $400 a month rent.
Right.
And
it's like, what am I doing?
Yeah. I went to take a friend to work one day and the road that I normally took her on was closed for construction. And so I went to cut through a parking lot of a hospital and like every exit of the hospital parking lot was blocked. And I just kind of like brought my car to a screeching halt. And I was like, this is my life.
Right.
Every road I try to take, every exit I try to make, it's blocked. Like, and I'm going nowhere. Like this parking lot is Missouri and my life. And I am literally on the way to nowhere. I just kind of like got out of the car and like, poor Caroline was just sitting in the car being like, are you going to take me to work or what?
Late, I was
like,
Robbie.
Yeah, I was like sitting in on the ground in the parking lot, just kind of like holding my head being like, what am I going to do? And so I took her to work and I remember I pulled into a gas station to call a friend of mine. And the only person I knew in the world outside of Springfield, Missouri was this guy, Jesse in Denver. And I had met him on ICQ, which was a, I don't know if you remember, you look a little too young, maybe you remember ICQ, but ICQ was like this.
I don't know, IC.
Yeah, it was this chat program. Like it predated like AOL Instant Messenger. It was like really big in Europe. It wasn't huge in the US, but I was on it and I met him and he's one of the people that helped me like come to terms with being gay. And so I called him and I'm like, you know, I've got to get out of here. And he's like, well, come to Denver. I'm like, I don't have a place to live. I absolutely don't have any money to move. I don't have a job. And he was like, well, you work on the place or you work on the job and the money and I'll find you a place to live. So he called back like an hour later. He's like, all right, my college roommate has a spare bedroom. You can live there till you find a place. And I'm like, all right. So I go into my shift at the body shop and I was like, you know, I want to move to Denver. I got to get out of here, but I don't have a job. I don't know what to do. And so my manager came out like an hour later and she's like, all right, you're now the assistant manager at the body shop at at the Denver airport.
Oh my God.
I was like, okay. And they were paying me, I was going to be so rich. They were paying me $24,000 a year. I was like, oh my God, I'm so rich. Like, this is insane. And I'm serious, because even working four jobs, I might have been pulling in, you know, like $8,000 a year at the most back then. And then I went home and I'm just like, all right, I have no money to get a U-Haul and like get myself across the country. And I looked and I had a ton of DVDs. And I
started slinging those DVDs.
I had a friend that worked at Best Buy, and I would go in and he'd scan a pack of gum and I'd go out with a bunch of DVDs. So that's why I had like 500 DVDs, and I took them all to Hastings Music, which was like this record DVD place back in the day. And I sold them and I made $500, and I used that to rent a U-Haul and get a trailer for my car that promptly died on me 3 days after moving to Colorado. And
common theme for you.
within 24 hours of that breakdown in the parking lot, I was in a U-Haul on the way to Denver. Cause I was like, I know if I don't do it,
that's
now,
wild, man.
I'm going to talk myself out of it. I'm going to talk myself out of it. And I'm not going to go because I'm going to get scared. Yeah. And I'm going to be like, this is illogical. You can't just move to Denver. And so I was just like, I've got to do it now. And if I think about it, I'll talk myself out of it. So I remember coming over a hill and seeing Denver filling up the valley right in front of the Rocky Mountains. And just like pulling over on the side of the road and being like, I have made a huge mistake. What was I thinking? This city is huge. This is massive. God, I've made such a dumb decision.
I only know
decision.
One person like, who I've never even met. Like,
yeah, I'm going to get eaten alive here. And then I remember fast forward like 3 years later, I'm like, this town is so small. Yeah. I got to get out of here. Like this cow town, I got to get to New York City. Yeah. But yeah, so I'm glad I didn't allow myself to talk myself out of going.
Yeah, that's amazing, man. We were just talking about yesterday too. Like, I feel like so many people come to that moment and that realization that sort of you were at. But I feel like the majority of the people just feel too stuck or feel like it's too hard or big to like make a change, and it can be so paralyzing. And I think to your point, it's really like, if you don't do it in that moment, then it's literally like, ugh, you know what? I have this person's birthday party this weekend. Like I'll work on it next week. And then it's just like a few next weeks go by, and before you know, you're still in Missouri, still, and it's here. Like 2 years later. Yeah. And it's like, I feel like so many people can relate to sort of feeling stuck or wanting to like shake up their snow globe of life, but just like don't have maybe the strength or the support to really make that change, because it can just feel so heavy and like so impossible. And it's like so refreshing to hear you talk about your experience of like, I'm sure it has to do with being young. Like, I feel like when you're a kid, it's like, you know, there's less stakes. It doesn't matter as much. You can sort of just fly by the seat of your pants. But how do you feel like you had the strength or the independence, I guess, to just do it on a whim like that? Was it just so dire? Or like, I feel like it's not very common for people to really be able to do that.
I don't know. I honestly really don't know. I think it's just, I've always wanted more. Growing up, I was often told that I was, you know, not going to amount to anything. Right. I was going to end up in jail, which I have a couple of times just overnight. That's being gay, I'd never amount to anything. I'd never be successful. No one would ever love me. And I think it was that really just fueled my drive to be like, I've got to do more. I've got to do better. I've got to show them.
That's super powerful. And I feel like it's kind of interesting too, because I feel like for most kids, even just like reading about your story, it's like when you're a kid, you're sort of trying to find like your thing, right? Like, where do I fit in school? Am I a smart kid? Do I play sports? Am I a theater kid? Am I in the band or whatever? And those things. But I feel like for you, it was almost sort of like figuring out yourself was your thing first. And then maybe that sort of career or like interest and passions came after. Is that fair to say?
No, I mean, I think I was still that kid trying to find the other things as well. But, you know, it was weird. I was not a popular kid by any means. But I was also like not an unpopular kid, like
middle of the pack. Middle of the pack kid.
Yeah, I mean, since I really didn't know who I was, like I didn't really fit in to anyone's right. group, but because of that, you know, like often when you're in one specific group, then the other groups are like, oh, this right. is who it's they like are. Totally they're not a part of us. Yeah. Yeah, but for me, it's like, I remember I ran for class treasurer and student council my sophomore year against one of the most popular girls in school. And I was like, oh, there's no way I'm going to win this. But I did.
Wow.
Yeah. She was obviously like super shocked because she was, you know, cheerleader, popular girl. She totally thought she was going right. to win. But the thing is, her popular kids loved her, but everybody else hated her.
Right. Like you're in your bubble. Yeah.
Yeah. Nobody hated me. They might not have thought I was popular, but nobody hated me.
No, that's funny.
Yeah.
When did sort of the like design and like artful sort of aspect come into play for you then?
I mean, when I was like 5 or 6 years old, and this is a story I talk about in my book, you know, my mom had decorated my room in all red.
Wow.
You know, red. Yeah.
Intense.
Red curtains, red, red, red. Like fire engine red, you know, fire trucks, little boys. Red is for boys.
Don't they say that that's actually like can be very like damaging if you paint your room red to just like really incite like anger and violence and things like that? Yeah.
Yes.
Like a real
and,
thing.
I, yeah. And I felt that. Even as a kid, I felt that. And so I saved up my little birthday checks from my aunts and uncles and grandma and like talked to my mom into letting me buy home decor for my birthday at like 5 or 6 years old. And I switched out all the red to blue because I just, there's something about blue that made me feel good. And I,
it's a little more calm.
Yeah. I designed the blues around this dinosaur poster I had found because I was obsessed with dinosaurs. And, you know, so I think even at a young age, I understood the power of your space and how your space can affect your mental health.
Yeah. Yeah. I think especially color, like when you talk about just thinking about a red to a blue, we all just get like a feeling and a vision in our mind and like an ease that sort of washes over us in that way. But that's cool. I didn't realize that that was sort of that you had that bug from that young age also.
You know, I definitely don't think that put me on the track to design at the time. You know, I didn't understand yeah. that. You know, I didn't, growing up on a farm, like interior design was not right. an option for a career. And even, I remember though, as a teen, like walking into Target and like their very first designer collaboration was with an architect named Michael Graves. I don't know if you remember that, but it was like tea kettles and toasters and spatulas. And like, it was really cool, unique kitchen stuff. I remember walking in and like looking at one of the spoons and smiling and like, huh, that spoon makes me happy. And I had never really thought about there's people out there not only making things that are functional, you know, a spoon is utilitarian. It's just something to shovel food in your mouth. But in turn, it can also be something that the design of it can make you smile, you know? And I think at that point in my life, I started realizing there are people out there that are designing the world and that design can change the world and that design can make you happy, you know, not just in your home, but outside of your home as well.
Yeah. Like the realization of like the intention behind just everyday common objects. They're not just like, you know, printed by a robot that we all just look exactly the same. So when you landed in Denver, I guess, was that sort of your idea to continue to pursue? I mean, I know you had the body shop experience, restaurant experience, like were you sort of putting the pieces together at that point or
mean,
still
I still, you know, I still was I was a high school dropout. You know, I left at the end of my sophomore year. I re-enrolled the beginning of my junior year, but within a month I wasn't able to pay my rent and eat and go to school.
I only made it a couple years further than you, so I can I can relate.
So, you know, like I didn't have a high school degree. I definitely didn't have a college degree. And, you know, you're always told that you can't do a career like that unless you have the education for it. You know, oh, college. You can't do anything if you don't have a college degree. And I kind of subscribed to that way of thinking because it was drilled in my head for so long. So, you know, I was working at the Bombay Company and the Gap and Applebee's. I was still just kind of doing dead end jobs just to pay the bills, but I wasn't going anywhere with it. And even in beginning of 2003, mid 2003-ish, I decided that I wanted to move to New York. Actually, early 2003, because I moved there June 23rd, 2003. I went out there to visit somebody, and I ended up meeting somebody else and falling in love and being like, oh, New York's where I want to be. I'm going to move and move in with him. We only lasted like 3 months, but
that's fine though. He luckily got you there.
Yeah, no, luckily, actually, we broke up before I moved there, because if I had moved there with him, I would have been out in like Woodbridge, New Jersey.
That's not where you want to be.
Yeah. So, but because of the amount of time I came out to visit him, I fell in love with the city. And it was like, this is where I need to be. Like, this is where I feel at home. This is where I can really make something of myself.
Yeah.
And I went there with no job, no nothing, like $100 in a suitcase. And I was like, oh, I'm just going to get a job as a server.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll wait tables. But when I got there, I quickly learned that if you don't have New York City experience, like restaurants won't hire you. So that plan kind of got screwed. But eventually I got a job as a manager at Restoration Hardware, like the merchandising manager.
Yeah.
And I worked there for, I don't know, 6 months to a year. And then I went to work for Bed Bath Beyond. And then.
Right. And this is where it sort of all started coming together a little bit.
Yeah. And then I ended up working for a high-end furniture company named Portico. And I worked my way up from a store manager to buyer to creative director. And one day that company just went belly up and bankrupt. And so I had also built their e-commerce division. And so I went online and I registered bobbyburkhome.com, and I'm like, I cloned their database and I put it on my own website, and I'm like, maybe I'll sell a sofa or two while I look for another job. And I ended up selling more than a few, and it actually became quite successful. And I then opened up a store in Soho, and then one in Miami, and then Atlanta, and then LA. And then that was 2007 when I started opening up stores. And then 2015 rolled around and I decided to focus on just the design aspect of it.
Yeah.
We had been starting getting a lot of gigs designing people's homes as well.
Right.
So I opened up a design firm. We moved to LA. As leases were up in stores, I started getting rid of those because I was focusing more on design.
And right.
2016, queer, I came calling.
Yeah. It's so amazing how like I can relate to you that I almost call myself like an accidental entrepreneur all the time, of like I wasn't trying to be a businessman or start a company, or I dropped out of college after one semester. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I was driving for Postmates. I like, you know, was literally, I just had to do something or my mom was going to kick me out of the house. And just like clothing was just the first outlet for me to sort of express myself, of like, let me go get a white t-shirt and let me print something on it. And similar to you, you know, it sort of just started as like a side hobby or we'll see. And then, you know, sort of just the world reacts to it, however the world reacts to it. And then you like find yourself being able to grow a business and impact people and build a community and all these things. But it, I mean, similar to me, it seems for you, like it, you just sort of stumbled into it. It all sort of happened after you got that site up, which is pretty amazing. I imagine you're like, you had basically no expectations.
No. And I mean, nobody was selling furniture online in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was no, I was one of only like maybe one or two websites on the internet that was selling furniture, which was one of the hardest issues, like getting manufacturers to sell to me. Cause they're like, online, no one's going to want to buy furniture online. That's crazy.
Right. They got to sit on it first. Yeah.
Yeah. Like that's literally why I opened up my first store, was so I'd have a brick and mortar location, so manufacturers would actually sell me their products.
What was sort of the like creative idea or identity that you thought of at that time, of like, you know, putting your name Bobby Burke Home on it? Like, what was sort of the inspiration or the aesthetic, I guess, that you were sort of going for? Or like, was it even that thought out, or it was just like,
I was just going for a sale. You know, I was just going to try to make some money to pay my rent.
Sort of seeing like what else was in the market, just what you knew people were buying, like.
Yeah, you know, I was really good at curating other brands, you know, and because at the time, like, it was under Bobby Burke Home, but it was just, I was a retailer that was curating other people's stuff.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right. Like, you weren't designing or manufacturing anything of your own. Like, you were just wholesaling other people's items.
It's hard to do that with furniture.
Right. Just like out the gate.
Yeah. Years later, yes, I was and still am. But yeah, no, off the gate, I was just, you know, I was a retailer, just reselling other people's stuff. And the business model I created, which no one was doing at the time, was, you know, retailers back then, they had to hold stock. You know, if you wanted to carry product, you held stock, you held all the liability. But I got these manufacturers to, you know, just ship stuff for me when I'd sell it.
Right. Like just everything made to order.
Yeah. Like drop ship wasn't a thing back then.
Yeah.
You know, now obviously it's everything.
But yeah.
Back then you were like, what do you mean you don't want to have a warehouse full of our stuff? You want us to just warehouse it for you? And I'm like, That's exactly what I want you to do. And they're like, well, that's weird. We've never done that before. I'm like, ah, let's try it. And then like that main manufacturer, fast forward a few years later, I was one of their largest US retailers.
Wow. So were you doing everything by yourself, or did you bring like partners in, or?
Well, I was doing everything by myself. I've never had a partner. I've never taken a loan for the business. I was doing it all organically. I mean, I had a lot of fake employees. There was multiple different email addresses and all these different employees in the accounting department and this and that. You know, in the beginning, I made the company look way bigger than it was. It was literally just me, you know, running things in my underwear on my Upper East Side apartment.
What were like, I mean, aside from having an e-commerce business prior to 2010, I guess, what were some of the biggest like challenges that you faced? I mean, to just literally launch your own company fully by yourself at that time, obviously with no experience, like looking back, what were some of like the biggest struggles at that time?
I mean, my biggest struggle was just like not having any knowledge at all how to run a business,
right?
You know,
but I feel like that's almost like a pro, like in hindsight, like same for us. It's like we never abided to any fashion calendar. It's like we'll drop stuff when we want to drop it. It's like, because we didn't know any better. If we had gone to fashion school, it probably would have been like, no, you release product like this and it looks like this. It's like,
and the funny thing is, I years later, when I had multiple stores, I ended up hiring somebody to like be the business part of it, and he'd somebody I had known for years, and he had an MBA and everything,
right?
And checks every the time boxes, I'd be like, yeah. I'd be like, oh, let's do this, and he's like, oh, no, you can't do that. I'm like, oh, let's do this. And he's like, oh, no.
It's like, why?
You can't do that. I was like, oh, well, we're going to do it anyways. And he's like, you know, finally one day he's like, I think the key to your success is that you don't have that business education background telling you that these are the steps to success.
Right. Like the certain way.
You're just like, yeah, let's try this. And if it doesn't work, you just try something else. And you know, it's never like, oh, that didn't work. Oh, we're going to fold. It was just like, oh, well, okay, we'll pivot. All right. We'll try this. We'll pivot, you know? So he's like, I think that's been the key to your success, is you really have no idea what you're doing. So you're just willing to try whatever.
Yeah. I think that's like the coolest thing about just any, I mean, if you look at a lot of successful entrepreneurs, there's a lot of college dropouts or whatever, but it's just like that status quo or like no real rule book to follow that I think, you know, totally shakes up the industry, obviously with like the e-commerce space specifically. I guess fast forwarding to the book a little bit, like what was sort of the genesis for that? Had you always sort of wanted to write a book? I love, as I mentioned earlier, just sort of like the clear mental health theme of the book. I think there's so much meat on that bone. What was that sort of idea?
You know, people have been trying to get me to do a design book for years, especially since the show's come out, you know, like all my castmates did books. Everyone's like, where's your book? Why haven't you done a design book? And I'm like, you know, I'll do a book when I'm ready to do a book.
Right. I'm not just going to do a book for the sake of doing a book. Yeah.
Yeah. Which, you know, I feel like some of them did.
Yeah.
You know? Like, oh, let's jump on this train now. Right. Let's just do a book. Like,
capitalize on everything as much as you can. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's not the way I roll. You know, I find that a lot of design books actually make people feel bad about their space. They make their space feel inadequate. And that's not to knock any design book. Every design book is beautiful in its own way. But I wanted to make write a book that would inspire people, that would help them be at peace with their space, would give them the tools to make their space really work for them, and not push a design point of view, not push my design perspective on them, but give them the tools to find their own design perspective, and let everybody realize that anybody can be a designer if they can figure out the things that make them happy.
Mm. So was the idea to sort of just lay out sort of multiple perspectives and make it more about like the self of like just lead with where you sort of gravitate to? Or
You know, the first chapter is about, you know, I think one of the first things I say is let's normalize not asking people what their design aesthetic is, because it's putting them in a box. So, like,
what's your vibe? Yeah,
it's like, yeah. It's like, especially like on the show, you know, I would ask that in the beginning, because that was our normal question.
Well, yeah, you want to get to know someone. It seems like a common
thing. Answers like, you know, French industrial, and I'm like, are you sure? Like, do you even know what that is? Well, no, not really. It's just something I heard once. You know, I find that when you ask people that question, if they hadn't really thought about before, if they hadn't really even thought about.
There's like pressure. Yeah. There's like pressure to like almost say something that isn't even really you, but just what you think someone would like think you're cool to say. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. Like, you're putting yourself in a box that you might like that, but it might not be, you know, giving you the the vibe that it needs to give, you know? So the first chapter is just like figuring out what makes you happy. And most of it is about nothing about design. It's, you know, where's your dream vacation? When was the last time you felt safe? You know, what's your favorite television show? Like, you know, we had a hero on the show once and I asked him, you know, again, this was in the early days. I was like, what's your design aesthetic? And he's like, I have no idea. You know, I'm a 27-year-old bachelor. I've never had my own place before. He's like, this is never even something that even was a thought process in my head. So I'm like, all right, well, I'm like, what's your favorite show? And he's like, Mad Men. And I was like, oh, mid-century. And I'm like, you know, what's your dream vacation? And he's like, Cuba. And I'm like, also kind of stuck in the 50s, you know? So I did mid-century modern furniture, and it's a really cool mural photograph of a cafe in Havana and like banana leaf wallpaper in the breakfast nook, and like made it like this mid-century Cuban feel. And he walks in, he's like, oh my God, I've never imagined a home could feel more like home to me than this does. But he's like, I gave you nothing. You asked me and I gave you nothing. And I'm like, no, you actually gave me everything, because you told me the things that you were passionate about and that made you happy. And now that you're surrounded by those things, they're really filling your cup, and they're really recharging you, because you're surrounding yourself by things that aren't just from a magazine, aren't just because some designer said that this is the way your home should look. You filled your home with things that really spark joy for you. And that's what your home should do.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like breaking that mold. I feel like people only think of like four or five. You want like modern, you want Spanish, you want mid-century. It's like there's so much more to just those like classic answers of just like, what are you into? What restaurants do you like to eat at? What, oh, do you like sports? You like nature? It's like, you know, like you can build aesthetics around all these other things outside of just traditional like ID or like architecture. But I guess the byline of the book, how good design is good for the mind, I guess to answer that question, how is it actually good for the mind? And like, what did you find on this journey that really sort of like backed that up in that way?
You know, there's a lot of chapters in the book. There's a chapter that talks about organization. Obviously, like organization is a big thing. And most design books, you know, don't really talk about organizing. It's just about decorating. But there's a whole chapter about organizing and how to even start. You know, a lot of times people will have a very disorganized space and they'll be like, okay, I'm going to start with organizing my closet or my kitchen, and you're biting off too much that you can chew and you don't accomplish it. And then you fail at it. And then it prevents you from doing more and doing better. So I always say, you know, start with your junk drawer, start with something small, you know, get that little subconscious notch of accomplishment that's going to propel you to the next project and help you really accomplish it. So organization, a huge thing, you know, when you're surrounded by chaos around you, it really does create chaos in your mind. You know, when I'm sitting in a space that's a mess and that's cluttered, I can't focus, you know, I can't focus on anything, much less work. You know, there's a whole chapter about sleep and my 10 mantras and my 10 steps for better sleep. And, you know, a lot of times people have issues sleeping. And we talk about, again, clutter. You know, if your nightstand is full of clutter, you're surrounded by that. That's what you're seeing before you go to bed. That's what you're seeing the moment you wake up. You're going to bed with chaos. You're waking up with chaos. The same if the rest of your room is cluttered. Also, like, lighting is a huge deal. You know, people are like, oh, you know, I have such a hard time falling asleep right away. I lay in bed for like an hour or two after I get in bed. I'm like, oh, well, how many hours before you want to go to sleep are you dimming your lights? And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, our bodies start producing melatonin when the lights go down. You know, right. We evolved under the stars. Our bodies know when it gets dark.
Screens included. Like, yeah.
Yeah. So if you're sitting under these bright lights right until your time to go to bed, you have not preconditioned your body at all to be like, hey, it's time to go to bed. So now it's like, oh, okay, I'm going to start preparing myself for sleep. But then you're laying there for hours. So things like that, like really thinking about how your space can affect even your sleep patterns. There's a whole chapter about color and the way to, you know, going back to the red bedroom, you know, the way some colors can give you anxiety and some colors can make you more zen, you know, dark colors, light colors, and even the warmth spectrum on lighting, you know, the Kelvin scale, warm lighting versus cool, bright blue light. You know, a lot of times people are like, oh, you know, bright white blue light, I hate that. Or, you know, and I don't love it either from a design perspective, but, you know, the sun emits a bright white blue light. We don't really see it, but it does. And it's energizing. It wakes us up. Again, we evolved under the sun and the stars, you know, so in spaces that you need to focus, that you need to be alert, you know, use a more white blue light. And in spaces that are more relaxing, that you want to be in more zen in, you know, like your living room, your bedroom, you use a more warm amber light because it relaxes us and it makes us more on the sleepy side than the other side. So just things like that, like really helping you think about what you're putting in your home, not just design wise, but lighting, color, organization.
It's underrated how much psychology there is in like all of those aspects and how they do literally affect our mood. And I love how you approach it from just the more accessible sort of like micro goals, step-by-step angle. Cause even for me, you know, it's like, I have a few things that I really try and do every day. Like I want to make my bed before I leave the house. I want to just like put the dirty clothes in the laundry. Like even things as small as I like notice that like when I put just like the cap back on my toothpaste, right? Instead of just leaving it next to it, it's just like those little things that sort of just make you feel more tidy and in order. And I think you always come back, like when you get home from a long day at work and you walk into a clean room, I think it genuinely like you feel good and like you actually feel good, you know? And I think even if it's subconscious, it's like it's clear that these things do really have an effect and have an impact on us that we take with us throughout our day.
Yeah, it's funny you should bring up the making of the bed and the laundry, because it's an example I always use. You know, you tell yourself you're going to make that bed and you do. All right. So you make your bed and you've got a little subconscious notch of accomplishment. You released a little endorphin that I accomplished a goal I set out to accomplish. I mean, it's the tiniest little thing. It's making your bed, but you get to work and your mind is already preconditioned to succeed. It's already preconditioned for success. It's already preconditioned to be like, I can achieve the goals that I have set out to do because I've already done it today, you know? But in turn, you go to walk out the door and you're like, I didn't make that bed. It's not a big deal, whatever. It's a little subconscious notch of failure. There's no endorphins. And by the time you get to work, that thing that you were going to do, that goal that you had set, you're like, it's okay. I can do it later. Because you already preconditioned your mind that it's okay to not achieve the goals that I've set out to do. It's okay to procrastinate. And you've preconditioned your mind to be on that road to not being successful. So little things like that, you know, the pile of laundry in the bedroom that you told yourself you were going to do. You go to bed that night and the last thing you see before you go to bed is that thing that you wanted to accomplish and you didn't. And again, it's not that big of a deal. It's just laundry. But the next morning you wake up and the first thing you're confronted with is the goal you didn't achieve the day before. And when that starts to happen over and over, you really start to subconsciously tell yourself, it's okay to not achieve goals.
Right. Like nothing bad happened to me. I didn't get in trouble, obviously. It's like, you know, in silo, it's not that bad, but it does sort of have a ripple effect.
Yeah. Yeah, it really does affect you subconsciously.
I noticed how you mentioned earlier, talk about like you always wanted like more, you know, like moving from this place, I want bigger, I want better, all those sorts of things. And I feel like that's definitely a common thing that a lot of people want. But I also feel like it can be like a detriment at times, right? Like the disease of more in that way. Like I'm curious for you now, like do you feel like you've reached a place where it's like, you know, you feel like you have everything you need and you've arrived? Or are there still sort of like goals and you're very future oriented of like, I want more in X or Y? Or like, how do you feel like that has now stayed with you like later in life?
Yeah, no, I still kind of have that mindset. it's not like things wise.
Yeah. Like not,
you know,
like, yeah.
But it's, I still have that mindset of I need to do more. You know, I still probably work more than most people in a week than they do in a month. But I like, if I'm not working every single day, if I take time off, I'm kind of hard on myself. I tried to get better. And honestly, COVID was kind of one of the best things that ever happened to me because it really made me take a step back and like, I need to enjoy life. I need to prioritize my mental health. I need to prioritize my relationships, you know, and start to be okay with the success I'm having being enough.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's super powerful. And I guess what are some like goals that you have for yourself, or like when you think about what more looks like? Obviously it's not I want a bigger house or a nicer car or whatever, but like, what are those sort of like accomplishments that you still feel like you want to check off?
You know, I'm working on a lot of my own projects now for TV, and like, I definitely want to see some of those come to fruition. Yeah. Yeah. So it's Queer Eye has been a lot of fun. Yeah, I feel like we've been on now for like 20, 30 years.
And lastly, Bobby, I guess just now, like I know you mentioned COVID and sort of that helps you gain perspective and sort of priorities and things like that. I guess like, what does your current mental health look like in terms of like practices that you try and do, or just your routine there?
one of the things that really does help my mental health is exercise. You know, I always used to kind of make fun of those people and that had to go to the gym every single day, and like their life revolved around like when they're in, I was just like, you need to get a grip. But I kind of become that person now, you know, like the last month and a half with the book tour and like my father passed. So I was going back home a lot. And
sorry to hear that.
Thank you. I've definitely noticed like a difference in my mental health, and not in a good way, because I haven't been doing that daily, like, you know, goal. Like my goal is to, I just cycle every single day. I work out every single day, and it's been like, you know, twice a week now. And I see a difference.
Yeah. Getting the heart like pumping like that and breaking a sweat. I mean, like exercise is nature's antidepressant. And even I just started really working out like seriously for the first time, like 4 months ago. And it's like completely changed my life in that way. So that's a great one.
And I've worked out for years, but it wasn't a priority. It wasn't something that I was doing for myself. It was something that I was doing for everyone else.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Like, that's a huge distinction.
Yeah. And now it's something I do for myself.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for coming on, man. Congrats on the book. Congrats on the show. Really love just to hear about your journey and just how fearless and independent and vulnerable you've been along the way. And we're huge fans of you over here. So thanks again for coming on.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
The Mad Happy Podcast is brought to you by Optimism.